Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect program. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the program, please press star, then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this program is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your host for today's program, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, Tanisha, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect program, Difficult Side Effects of Breast Cancer Treatment. Memory changes, lymphedema, and neuropathy will be the focus of our talk today. Now, I want to acknowledge that today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and a number of other organizations that have really enabled us to reach so many of you. And we have on the call today over 926 participants. You come from all over the United States, from all different communities of the United States, from large cities, smaller cities, rural areas, suburban areas, just from everywhere, all of the United States. And we also have international participants today from Canada, Egypt, India, Kenya, Peru, and Thailand. So you really come from all over the world and are clearly a group of information seekers. I would like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there's an outline that our speakers have prepared. And there's information about the speakers. There also is a lot of information about all of the different organizations that we've collaborated with today. And there are some very helpful fact sheets that you've received as well. Now, there also is an evaluation form, and I ask you to take a moment at the end of today's program and complete that evaluation form. You know, who but each of you can tell us what you most need us to do, you know, what programs you want us to do, what topics you'd like us to cover. Indeed, the topics for today's program are really based on your recommendations from previous programs that we've done. So please take a moment and let us know, you know, what you'd like us to do in the future. That's very helpful. Now, today's program is made possible by a grant from the Avon Foundation, and I really want to thank them for supporting this really very special program that we're doing today. We have seven speakers, and I want to start and introducing our very first speaker is Dr. Rhonda Henry-Tillman. She's Medical Director, Women's Oncology Clinic, Director, Cancer Control, Arkansas Cancer Research Center. And Dr. Tillman is really going to start by really setting the context of the program today and saying something about breast cancer, giving an overview of breast cancer. Dr. Tillman?
Thank you. I'd like to first start with what is cancer and what is breast cancer. If you think about cancer is where you have cells that actually grow out of control within the body. And a specific cancer is named for which that abnormality grows out of control. For example, breast. If you have cells that grow out of control within the breast, it's called breast cancer. We diagnose breast cancer through someone filling a mass within their breast or by screening. If a patient is defined, screening is defined breast cancer early when it's small and confined within the breast. But often women will fill a mass within the breast that will require a biopsy. If a biopsy is performed and this comes back as a cancer, this may require treatment. This is where it's important to understand what is treatment for breast cancer. There are two major goals of breast cancer treatment, and they're pretty straightforward. One, it is to rid the body of all the cancer. That's the organ that which it started in, or if it's in other parts of the body, and to prevent this cancer from returning. We do this in two ways. One, we do this through surgery. And breast cancer surgery depends on how big the tumor is within the breast and whether there's spread of the tumor outside of the breast. So let's start with just breast cancer treatment within the breast. If it's a small tumor, you can perform a lumpectomy. A lumpectomy is where you remove the tumor from the breast with normal tissue surrounding that. Some people also call this a partial mastectomy, or if a large amount of the breast tissue is removed, it may be called a segmentectomy. The other option is to remove the breast at the same time removing the tumor, and that's called a mastectomy. Now, to evaluate whether the tumor has spread to other parts of the body, we start by evaluating the lymph nodes underneath the arm or the axilla. And this may be done by a procedure called the sentinel lymph node, where we find the first lymph node that drains that breast or tumor, or if the lymph nodes are felt under the arm, we perform what we call an axillary node dissection. If you perform an axillary node dissection with a mastectomy, that's called a modified radical mastectomy. So just to go back to that, your options are lumpectomy or mastectomy with or without removal of the lymph node, depending on the spread. Now, we can't just stop with the surgery because we know the combination treatment gives us the best chance for preventing recurrence and for survival. So we have to do something as well to prevent the tumor from coming back, and that's called adjuvant therapy. If we talk about adjuvant therapy for treatment or local control within the breast, if you perform a lumpectomy, we use radiation or partial breast radiation, where we're just treating the site where we remove the tumor. Now, everyone will not need radiation. It, again, depends on the type of tumor that is found within the breast or what type of surgery you have. If you have a mastectomy, if you don't have any lymph nodes positive, or you have 1 to 4 lymph nodes positive, you won't need radiation. But if you have a large tumor within the breast that involves the muscle, or you have a large number of lymph nodes, more than 4 lymph nodes positive, you will need to add radiation to that. So that is called local treatment. It just treats that organ at site. Now, to prevent spread of the tumor or treat tumor cells within the bloodstream or within the lymphatics, we give adjuvant therapy called chemotherapy. And there are different types of chemotherapy, and the doctor may choose a specific regimen depending on your tumor type. The other type of adjuvant therapy is called hormonal therapy, and that's when you give a treatment that blocks the estrogen receptor or is a specific tumor like a monoclonal antibody that's specific for that type of cancer. Now, as much as breast cancer treatment has advanced, we're still not at the stage where we advance where they're not complications from breast cancer surgeries. And we have a large expert of members on the panel that are going to discuss some of those complications from breast surgery that may include lymphedema or treatment from chemotherapy such as neuropathy and pain and memory loss. This concludes my presentation on overview of breast cancer.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Tillman, for just a very excellent overview and really for starting setting the stage for our program today. And our next speaker is Dr. Linda Vidot, and Dr. Vidot is Medical Director of Breast Cancer Research Program, Weill Medical College of Cornell University. And Dr. Vidot is going to actually talk a bit about some of these side effects with a focus on neuropathy. Dr. Vidot?
Thank you very much, Carolyn, and thank you to all of the participants today for dialing in to learn how you can help yourself or someone you know. As Dr. Tillman touched on, chemotherapy is sometimes used to prevent cancer from coming back, and chemotherapy is usually used when cancer has come back. And while we've made tremendous strides in improving outcome from a breast cancer diagnosis, there's still a lot of work to do in terms of reducing some of the side effects. So today I'm going to talk a little bit about something called peripheral neuropathy. And peripheral neuropathy is a common side effect of a wide variety of cancer-treating agents. Peripheral neuropathy can be described as symptoms of numbness, tingling, or pain in the extremities, usually the hands or the feet or both. But before we start talking about peripheral neuropathy specifically, let's go over some of the basic facts of the nervous system so that we can make sure we understand each other. The nervous system is an intricate collection of nerves in the body, and they are broadly divided into several big categories. The central nervous system, which is usually the brain and the spinal cord, is one. The autonomic nervous system, which controls automatic functions such as breathing and the machinery for digestion. And the peripheral nervous system, which is like its name and is out in the periphery, are mostly nerves involved with the function of the arms and the legs. In general, nerves are divided up into categories of motor nerves and sensory nerves. Their functions are like their names. For motor nerves, they are involved in movement, and sensory nerves are involved in sensation, so it makes a lot of sense. You have to think of all the nerves as starting in the brain and having long branches out to specific areas of the body. So, for example, a single nerve in your fingertip has a specific place it reports to in your brain. This is the case all over your body. Mechanically, nerve conduction, or how they communicate with each other, is usually achieved by short segments of nerves that send messages to each other at lightning-fast speed, both to and from the brain, which is the control center for all the nerves. Lots of different kinds of nerve fibers exist. There are large nerve fibers and small nerve fibers. There are specific nerve fibers, which are involved in the transmission of sensation, of pain, different nerve fibers that transmit temperature sensation. So all nerves are not created equal. There are even different nerve fibers that tell your fingers and your toes where they are located in relation to the rest of your body. And we call that joint position sense, or a really fancy word called proprioceptive nerves. Other nerves, the motor nerves, enable you to move a finger or a toe or other part of your body. So as you can see, from a functional perspective, this territory is all carved up. Now, nerves are very tricky, and there is still a lot we don't know about them. But one thing we do know is that they have a very complex structure, and their communication pathways are very complicated. In fact, another thing we know about them is that if they are damaged, they take a very long time to repair themselves, and sometimes can't even repair themselves, unlike many other parts of the body. So with this as a background, let's move back to our topic of chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy. As we mentioned before, a lot of chemotherapy drugs can cause symptoms of peripheral neuropathy. Peripheral neuropathy is described as symptoms of numbness, tingling, or pain in the extremities, usually the hands or feet or both. Some of the frequent signs of peripheral neuropathy are an alteration in sensations, such as the ability to feel a pinprick or the ability to figure out the placement of your extremities, as well as the inability to discern temperature sensations, so for example, hot versus cold. Examples of motor neuropathy include any weakness or disturbances in walking. Sometimes the first sign of a motor weakness can be the inability to point your big toe on your foot towards the ceiling. Sometimes that can progress to the inability to flex your foot at the ankle. And this can be a big problem because sometimes it can lead to something we call a foot drop, which makes it difficult to walk without falling over or tripping because the foot is totally floppy. From a functional perspective, those with peripheral neuropathy can have difficulty walking or driving a vehicle, either due to the symptoms such as weakness or the loss of knowing where your feet are in the car relative to the accelerator. And frequently patients tell me that when they feel they are walking on cotton or have wooden blocks on their feet when they walk. Those are examples of peripheral neuropathy. As a consequence of the numbness or the tingling, a patient with some moderate symptoms of a peripheral neuropathy can find it difficult to hold a pen to write, work buttons, open jars, turn door handles, or any manipulation which requires fine motor coordination. And when these kinds of things happen, we usually term them as interfering with something we call ADLs, or activities of daily living. And these are the kinds of things that you need to share with your healthcare team, because it's important for them to be in the loop in terms of these side effects, so there are certain things they can do to reduce them. So many drugs, chemotherapy drugs in particular, can cause peripheral neuropathy. These include drugs such as cisplatin, carboplatin, Taxol, Taxotere, Navaldine, Oxaliplatin, and Velcade, among others. Even some drugs that are not really considered chemotherapy, such as thalidomide, which is used for multiple myeloma, can also cause peripheral neuropathy. Sometimes peripheral neuropathy can creep up on a person, or it can be severe from the outset. I would say it creeps up on most people. The first sign can be that one feels a transient tingling in their fingers or their toes during a chemotherapy infusion. As time goes on and the treatment continues, these symptoms can persist to lasting a few hours to lasting a few days, ultimately lasting for the entire time between cycles of therapy. It is important to let your healthcare provider know about these symptoms. The peripheral neuropathy associated with chemotherapy is cumulative, so it can be expected to get worse with more therapy. Depending on the treatment and the severity of symptoms, your doctor may opt to reduce the dose of the offending chemotherapy drug, or to lengthen the interval between treatments, or to stop it altogether. Usually the further you get away from treatment, the better the neuropathy gets. Most neuropathy resolves, but some don't. And I would say, in my experience, the patients who don't have their peripheral neuropathy resolved tend to be those who had a prior peripheral neuropathy coming into treatment, and certainly diabetics, I personally think are at risk. There has been a lot of research into why people get neuropathy and different ways to prevent it. I would say the bottom line is that there's still a lot of work to be done. Frequently, from a practical standpoint, though, even though one stops a neuropathy-causing drug, lots of times the second choice drug that your doctor may use can also cause peripheral neuropathy, and that's why it's a really big problem from a clinical point of view. Lots of different medicines have been used to reduce some of the symptoms of peripheral neuropathy, but none of them address the cause. Many years ago, there were several clinical trials looking at a drug called amifostine to prevent peripheral neuropathy from cisplatin chemotherapy. After encouraging early results, a randomized clinical trial where half the patients get amifostine and the rest get the equivalent of a sugar pill or sugar infusion determined that the sugar pill had the same effect as the amifostine, so unfortunately that didn't work out. Glutamine is another strategy that has been tried to prevent or reduce the signs of symptoms of peripheral neuropathy. Glutamine is an amino acid that is a building block of proteins in the blood. It has been used in one trial to reduce the signs and symptoms of neuropathy from very high-dose Taxol chemotherapy. In that trial, there was a suggestion that glutamine might be helpful, and now we're doing a randomized study where half of the patients get glutamine, the other half get a sugar pill to see if this is a real effect or not. One of the things that we have observed, though, is that if it is going to work, it works right away in our patients. You don't need to take glutamine for a month to figure out if it's working or not, so that at least is good. Recently, there was a paper published using vitamin E at a pretty high dose, at 600 milligrams a day, to try to prevent peripheral neuropathy in patients undergoing 6 cycles of Taxol chemotherapy. The authors noted that those who did not receive vitamin E supplementation were 3 times more likely to have peripheral neuropathy than those who did not. This research group did a similar trial in patients who were undergoing cisplatin chemotherapy, and they found similar results in that those who received vitamin E were 2.5 times less likely to have neuropathy than those who didn't receive vitamin E. You know, vitamin E is an antioxidant, and as someone who gives chemotherapy, we're certainly very concerned that in theory it could counteract the effects of the chemotherapy. So certainly more work needs to be done on these observations, but they're encouraging. The major medicines used to treat some of the symptoms of peripheral neuropathy are drugs used as antidepressants or anti-seizure medications. Amitriptyline, also known as Elavil, has been used for decades to treat peripheral neuropathy, mostly the pain component. It is particularly useful to take at night because sleepiness is one of its major side effects. Gabapentin and Neurontin are effective medications, but I think that Dr. Coyle is going to talk a little bit more about that, along with drugs such as Lyrica or Cymbalta. So the good news is that I think researchers are beginning to look at neuropathy in a different way and not think that all neuropathy is the same, which is a good sign. And because of this, I think we will make some major strides in neuropathy research over the next few years. And that concludes my remarks for this section.
Thank you very much, Dr. Fadat, really for, again, doing an excellent presentation and really identifying some of the new clinical trials and research that's going on in neuropathy. Now, our next speaker is Dr. Nessa Coyle, and Dr. Coyle is Pain and Palliative Care Service, Department of Neurology, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Dr. Coyle is really going to focus specifically on the day-to-day treatment of pain and symptom and neuropathy, and I'm going to turn the program over to Dr. Coyle.
Thank you very much, Carolyn. I'm a nurse practitioner who works with our Pain and Palliative Care Service, and I'm going to repeat some of the things that were said a little bit earlier, because I think to understand the causes of neuropathy are helpful in the management itself, but most painful neuropathies associated with cancer treatment are caused by damage to peripheral nerves from one of three causes, surgery, mastectomy, lumpectomy, or lymph node dissection, certain chemotherapy agents, as you heard, and also sometimes radiation therapy damage to the nerves. And often sensations that people complain about are burning, sometimes lancinating electric shock-like pains, a feeling of sometimes rawness or a deep, dull, bone-like ache. And sometimes a stimulus that's not normally painful does become painful, or a pinprick, for example, becomes extremely painful. So that when you look at surgery-related pain and neuropathy, this is usually described as burning, shooting, and electric shock-like sensations, and this can be around the surgical site. And if people are not familiar with this, that it can happen, they often don't tell their physician about it. It can be quite severe and disabling, and the treatment is a combination of pain medications, both the opioid drugs and sometimes the antidepressants or anticonvulsants, and also physical therapy is extremely important. Post-mastectomy pain is more common when there's been a lymph node dissection. Radiation-induced neuropathy or painful neuropathy used to be much more common in the 1960s, but now as radiation therapy has become more refined, it occurs less frequently. Sometimes there can be a weakness of the arm, which can occur many years after the radiation therapy, and sometimes the pain in the arm also develops several years after the radiation therapy course is completed. But this type of neuropathy is much less common now. When you have injury because of radiation therapy to what's called the brachial plexus, the nerve plexus in the arm and axilla region, the pain is usually in the upper part of the arm and sometimes can be felt also in the thumb and the index finger. But again, that type of neuropathy is less common now. Most commonly is the chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy. And often that occurs in very many different nerves. The symptoms usually begin in the feet and progress to the hands, and that's why it's often called a stocking and glove distribution. As you heard, several classes of chemotherapy can cause these peripheral neuropathies, the vincristins, vinblastin, paclitaxel, cisplatin, carboplatin, etc. Some of the things that can affect neuropathies, both short-term and long-term, people seem to be particularly sensitive to the toxicity of these drugs. The older individual, the cumulative dose, as you heard, sometimes when there's a combination of chemotherapy, and all of those have neurotoxic elements. And again, if someone has had a pre-existing neuropathy, like diabetic neuropathy, they're more likely to develop a chemotherapy-induced neuropathy. And for some people, there's a genetic susceptibility. When people are going to receive chemotherapy and during the process of receiving chemotherapy, there's usually an assessment to see whether peripheral neuropathy has existed in the past or is existing now. And again, it's treated very seriously because it can really affect one's quality of life, relationships, change in social function, etc. When you have an sensory examination, again, looking for neuropathy, you might find that, for example, that the nerve reflexes are less brisk or indeed can be absent. A light touch can be painful. And again, a single ping prick can be cause a great deal of pain. The focus of treatment for neuropathic pain is to first understand what's causing it and then to reduce the pain so that you can improve your physical and functional and reduce psychological distress and also generally improve the quality of life. And it usually involves a team approach. Medication, certainly, physical therapy, occupational therapy, relaxation therapy. Some of the topical treatments that we use are a combination of local anesthetic creams like Elmer cream, local anesthetic patches, a 5% patch, lidocaine patch, which is left on for 12 hours and then taken off for 12 hours. What's important to know with these patches is that some people are using, for example, a transdermal patch like a fentanyl patch for pain. And that patch is put anywhere at all on the body, not particularly over the site of the pain. And the drug is absorbed systemically. But when you're using a lidoderm patch for pain, you put it specifically on the area of the pain. And most of the action is at a peripheral level and doesn't go into the blood system. So the way you use these patches are different. The combination of drugs that we use, anticonvulsants and antidepressants, are really based on the way people describe the pain, the burning and the sharp shooting quality. For the sharp shooting quality, we use anticonvulsants like gabapentin or pregabalin. And the antidepressants we use would be amitriptyline, nortriptyline, bisoprolol. It varies. And again, because of the sedative effects of the antidepressants, people tend to prefer to take them at night. So that although these drugs were designed for different purposes, they've been found in the pain population to be very helpful in relieving neuropathic pain. We also use the opioid drugs, the narcotic drugs, and depending on the severity of the pain, we might use a combination drug like oxycodone and Percocet, acetaminophen, Tylenol, and in a combination form in Percocet. Other times we would use morphine, hydromorphone, and sometimes indeed methadone. And a drug like methadone in small doses has found to be particularly helpful for nerve damage, neuropathic pain. In some instances, when this pain has been quite refractory, we bring in our anesthesia colleagues to see if there are any neurolytic blocks that would be helpful for the individual. So the focus is really on a multidisciplinary approach, physical therapy and occupational therapy, and frequently using a combination of drugs, both topical application and also by mouth, and using both the opioids, the anti-convulsants, and the antidepressants. So I'll end my remarks here. Thank you, Carolyn.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Quill, for just an excellent presentation and really a lot of the specifics about different ways to manage this pain and discomfort. Thank you so much. Our next two speakers are really going to address lymphedema, and the first speaker I'm going to introduce is Diane Rasfanti, and she's a certified lymphedema therapist, Westbury Total Healthcare, and she's going to set the stage for understanding what lymphedema is. Diane?
Thank you very much. I feel it is important for what I want to do is briefly, on a very basic level, explain and describe the anatomy of the lymphatic system to you. So that way you can understand more so where the treatment protocols come from and understand a little bit more about what's going on within your own body. The lymphatic system really has two main components. It has the lymph nodes and the lymphatic vessels. On average, we have about between 600 and 700 lymph nodes within our entire body, the major lymph node groupings being in our neck, in our axillary region or our underarm. Abdominally, we have between 200 and 300 lymph nodes within our abdominal cavity, and then also major lymph node groupings in our groin or the inguinal lymph nodes. So these are the major groupings throughout the entire body. And then sporadically we have lymph nodes located in joint areas and then throughout the rest of the body. These lymph nodes are connected to each other via lymphatic vessels. And the lymphatic vessels, again, circulate throughout the entire body. The lymphatic system is similar to the circulatory system in the respect of the larger lymphatic vessels are in the center of our body, and as we go out to our limbs, the lymphatic vessels get finer and finer and finer. The lymphatic system really has two main functions. It's part of our immune system, so it helps fight off infection. That's why you hear a lot that the doctors want you to be very cautious of infection in the affected limb. And the second function of the lymphatic system, which deals more with lymphedema, is our lymphatic system is there to get rid of excess fluid from our body. Now, the lymphatic system works very hand-in-hand with our circulatory system. So when our blood leaves our heart, it's pumping at a certain compression, at a certain pressure. It's flowing through our body quickly. As it's returning to our heart, it's flowing with a little less pressure. So with that loss of pressure comes a loss of fluid from the circulatory system, and it sits in the tissue of our bodies. And that is the job of the lymphatic system, is to pick up that excess fluid, filter it through the lymph nodes, clean it, filter it, and bring it back into the circulatory system. So that the lymphatic system goes throughout the entire body and picks up the excess fluid from our tissues and returns it back to our circulatory system. So, how does this deal with lymphedema and breast cancer? When a breast cancer patient has an axillary node dissection, or the lymph nodes, some of the lymph nodes are removed from the axillary region for testing to see if there's any type of cancer spread and then to determine what your treatment protocol would be. On average, we have between 30 and 40 lymph nodes in each axillary region. So if we are removing some of these lymph nodes for testing, First of all, an incision has been made in the axillary region. So lymphatic vessels in that area have been cut. And then lymph nodes are removed from the axillary region. So now, say they removed 10 lymph nodes. We're not functioning with as many lymph nodes as we used to, so there can be a tendency to have some backup of lymphatic fluid in the affected arm. And what happens is, initially, the lymphatic system will try and control or contain the amount of backed up fluid in the arm. But at some point in time, it is possible that the amount of lymphatic fluid, the lymphatic vessels cannot contain the amount of lymphatic fluid in the arm anymore, and the lymphatic fluid will start to seep through the vessel walls and sit in the tissue of the arm. And this is when sometimes you as a patient might see or start to feel some of the sensations of lymphedema. So once this happens and the lymphatic system can't handle the amount of lymphatic fluid that the arm that is in the arm, you're starting what we will consider to, you're starting to get lymphedema, and at this point, it comes a time where your arm can't control the amount anymore, and you might need to get into a treatment type of program. So the definition of lymphedema is an abnormal accumulation of lymphatic fluid in the tissue of the body, usually in one of the extremities, because usually that's where the lymph node testing has been done. Symptoms of lymphedema. Very quickly, you might feel the arm is very full. You might feel a tightness in the skin. You might feel a decreased range of motion. So I don't want to – this. I'll conclude my portion of this here, so this way Sarah can then continue on with what the treatment protocol would be like.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Diane, for really so clearly defining lymphedema and explaining it, the anatomy of lymphedema to the audience. Our next speaker is Sarah Cohen. Sarah is Senior Occupational Therapist, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Sarah is going to talk about some of the ways to manage lymphedema. Sarah?
Yes, thank you, Carolyn, and thank you, Diane. That was great. As Diane just explained, the structure and the function of the lymph system guide the treatment recommendations. Now, there are four main treatment approaches, and I'll talk a little bit about each one. Many women are very distressed about the possibility that they might develop lymphedema and want to know what they can do preventatively. This is an ongoing discussion in the lymphedema community, and I'll touch on this briefly during my presentation. Because the lymph system works to remove bacteria from the tissue, as Diane explained, the first treatment is education about skin care. Anyone who has had lymph nodes removed has an increased risk for infection on the side of the surgery only. If you develop an infection, this can either trigger lymphedema or make your lymphedema worse. The likelihood is you won't get an infection if you get a cut or a burn, but you should use common sense and take a little bit better care of your skin on the surgical side just as a precaution. And if you see any signs of infection, like redness or warmth, particularly in combination with fever or chills, you should call your doctor right away. The second treatment is exercise. Exercise helps stimulate the vessels of the lymph system to move fluid out of the arm. Some doctors advise patients not to lift a certain amount of weight after surgery because this might theoretically provoke lymphedema. But recent studies have shown the opposite, that slowly and gradually increasing the amount of exercise actually helps to protect against lymphedema and does not make lymphedema worse if you have it. The jury is still out on this issue, but everyone agrees that doing daily stretches can help the lymph system keep working efficiently. The third treatment is manual lymphatic drainage. This is a very gentle form of massage that helps stimulate the vessels of the lymph system. The structure of the lymph system helps guide the order, the direction, and the pressure of the strokes that are used. The idea is to create an alternate pathway to redirect the fluid away from a damaged area towards a functioning part of the lymph system. This massage should be done by a trained lymphedema therapist. Often the therapist will also teach you how to do it yourself. I want to emphasize that this massage is slightly different from lymphatic massage, which, say, you might find at a spa. Lymphatic massage therapists are trained to stimulate a normal lymph system. Lymphedema therapists are occupational therapists, physical therapists, or massage therapists who have received special training in treating a damaged lymph system. The fourth treatment is compression. There are two main types of compression, compression garments and compression bandages. Compression garments help prevent additional fluid from building up in the arm and hand. These are generally used during the daytime. The other type of compression, low-stretch bandages, are often used with moderate or significant swelling. These special bandages are used to help reshape the arm and bring it back to a more normal size. Some people use the bandages at night to keep their swelling under control. You may have heard about using compression garments on airplane flights, which you should do if you already have swelling. If you don't have swelling, there are differing opinions about whether to use garments preventatively. My best advice is to discuss your particular situation with a lymphedema therapist to help you figure out what to do. As an occupational therapist, as well as a lymphedema therapist, I'm interested in your daily occupations or what you do during the course of a typical day. I want to know this because your activities can affect your swelling. My job is to help you stay engaged in your life and to figure out the best and the easiest home management program that keeps your swelling under control. This is a process that takes some time, but it's worth the effort. That concludes my remarks.
I want to thank you very much, Sarah, for really delineating the different ways that lymphedema can be managed. Thank you very much. Excellent. Our next speaker is Dr. Stuart Fleischman. Dr. Fleischman is Director, Cancer Supportive Services, Beth Israel Cancer Center, and Continuum Partners. And Dr. Fleischman is going to really focus on memory and thinking changes and practical ways to compensate for them. Dr. Fleischman.
Hi, everybody. This is a somewhat complex topic, and we'll try to review just the basics. This came to our attention pretty much about 10 or 15 years ago when patients were reporting that they had what they perceived as memory loss. They weren't able to remember information and couldn't do multitask or do a number of things at once. There was a book that was published right around that time by an author named Claire Warga called Menopause in the Mind, where she identified this exact same problem in women who were menopausal or perimenopausal. And it got us all thinking and investigating, and the more we asked, the more people spoke up and said that they were having memory problems after having chemotherapy. Well, with breast cancer, that's complicated by the fact that the breast cancer chemotherapy affects your hormone status, and many women, not all, but many women do lose their periods during their initial chemotherapy for breast cancer. But it does seem like it's not just the cancer and not just the hormonal changes, but the certain chemotherapies themselves that actually cause some damage. No one understands this mechanism exactly. It seems, from a logical point of view, that it is similar to the mechanism for peripheral neuropathy that was just addressed. There's speculation, though it's far from proven, that the chemotherapy doesn't affect the nerve cells themselves, but the supporting structure. So if you think of the nervous system like a bunch of highways, it's not the roadway, it's the columns that are holding up the elevated highways that are affected by the chemotherapy. But this is something that is really ripe for a lot of investigation in the future because we're really not certain about that. So what people are telling us is that they lose their train of thought, they'll walk into a room, they forget why they're there, they feel foggy, people use the word cotton-headed, thoughts are blocked, at loss for words, can't remember where they put their car in a mall, can't remember where they put their keys, their purse, their wallet, their glasses, the kinds of things like that. And it does seem that it's not a memory problem, but it's a coding problem. And although we call it a memory problem, it's not pulling the information out. My usual way to tell this is we have our clinicians ask the patients if they remember their second grade teacher, and most people can, but what did you have for breakfast today? Well, I'm not sure. So it's the new information going in. It's a coding problem. Those of us who are computer savvy, it's the save as function. It's not what's on the screen. It's getting it into your hard drive or getting into your flash drive that the problem seems to be. So there are a number of things that can be done, very practical things. In your packet today, list all of them. Make lists. Write things down. Have a schedule. Use a day planner, a Palm Pilot, some sort of schedule, whether it's paper or electronic. have a system of remembering things, color code things, put them in envelopes, use index cards, use post-it notes. Post-it notes are a rather very practical and simple problem, and cheap problem actually, to overcome organizational problems. And a lot of these techniques have been really developed by the traumatic brain injury world and are certainly applicable to the cancer world. Tell people what's happening. If you're able to be honest with people in your circle, tell them what's happening. Repeat back information. So if somebody says to you, I'll meet you on the third floor by the elevator, you say, by the elevator on the third floor? Got it. And that helps the new information to get coded even better. Not doing many things at once. One of the things that the women have complained to us about, they'll say that they used to be able to get home from work, cook dinner, supervise their kids' homework, watch TV, and talk on the phone at the same time. Now they can only do one or two of those things, and it's a major difference. Or at work, people are finding that they can do less multitasking. So slowing down isn't always the answer, but focusing on one activity at a time instead of multiples seems to be the way to go. There have been some drug trials looking at ways to overcome the problem. Again, it doesn't solve the problem, but it helps compensate for it. A trial that I had participated in, which was a multi-center trial looking at stimulant drugs, showed that stimulant drugs are very significant in helping overcome fatigue and are approaching statistical significance for helping overcome this type of memory problem after cancer chemotherapy, and is something that we need to look at more in the future. So practical things, electronic things, learning new things, and maybe a drug trial would be the way to overcome this problem. Many people ask us if it's permanent or not, and it seems that for a small minority of women, these are permanent changes, but the vast majority of women do either compensate, meaning that they learn new ways, as you heard about with the other neurological complications of cancer, or they just get used to being a little more limited, which is not what anybody would like to hear, but in fact we're somewhat more adaptive than we realize, and we actually can get used to the fact that we have to slow down, focus, and pay attention a little bit more. I'm going to stop so we can have adequate time for questions.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Fleischman, for really covering a complicated topic very well in a brief amount of time. So thank you. Our next and last speaker is Patricia Spicer. Patricia is an oncology social worker, and she's the breast cancer program coordinator for Cancer Care. And Pat's going to talk a bit about the services of Cancer Care. Pat?
Thank you, Carolyn. We've received a great deal of information today that will help you deal with some of the side effects of chemotherapy or a diagnosis you may be experiencing. But the important thing to remember is that unless you discuss this with your physician or with the nurse practitioner in the doctor's office, they can't be of help to you. And very often women are hesitant to admit that something is going wrong or there's some unexplained side effect after their treatment that they don't quite know what to do with. So please seek out help. And when you seek help, consider also calling Cancer Care. We can be reached at 1-800-813-4673 or online at www.cancercare.org. We offer support groups. We offer individual counseling. We offer telephone education workshops, such as you've been part of today. And all of our services are without cost. So we hope that you will utilize us as a source of resource and coping skills. Thank you, Carolyn.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Pat, for just really commenting on the complexity of all these issues and the importance of the doctor-patient communication, as well as utilizing resources like Cancer Care for additional support. Well, I want to thank all of our speakers today. It's really been a remarkable panel of speakers, I must say, for this call. It's rather remarkable, and probably it's a pioneering effort in doing all of these three topics together, these really difficult side effects of treatment. I also want to thank all of you who've actually queued up and asked such really excellent questions. Your questions always help to enhance the call and to allow us to elaborate more on some points that would be helpful to you. And I also want to thank all of you who've been listening on the call today. I do want to remind you this is a one-hour education program, and in planning a program like this, we recognize that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of a one-hour program. So although the program will be ending shortly, our services to you do not end. So Cancer Care is available to you. As Pat had said earlier, we do have a staff of national level oncology social workers who are available to provide all types of services to you. We provide practical and financial help. We provide counseling services, both individual and to families and children. We also provide support groups, both on the telephone and online. We provide lots of information to people, and we have all types of fact sheets and booklets that you can access from us, publications that we provide. So, and we do telephone education workshops as well. So there's hopefully something for everyone in all of the different things that we do, and that you will take advantage of the services that you think would be useful to you. We're very accessible to all of you by phone or online via our website, and we hope that you'll use those services. We're also entering into this really holiday period. It often poses a challenge for many people living with women living with breast cancer, and so I think that I just want to encourage all of you to take advantage of support services at this time if you're feeling a need to. And I want to thank you all very much for participating today. I don't want anyone to leave the call feeling that you're alone with any question or concern that you may have. You're not alone, that you're basically part of the cancer care community, and you can take advantage by calling upon us for help and support. Thank you for participating, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the program. You may now disconnect and have a wonderful day.